Now, some Americans only see the Mexico that is depicted in sensational headlines of violence and border crossings. And let's admit it, some Mexicans think that America disrespects Mexico or just wants to wall ourselves off. And in both countries, such distortions create misunderstandings that make it harder for us to move forward together. So I've come to Mexico because I think it's time for us to put the old mindsets aside. It's time to recognize new realities, including the impressive progress of today's Mexico.
President Obama speaking to a friendly Mexican audience back in May, the last time he was south of the border. He is back there today for a summit with his Mexican and Canadian counterparts, and he's expected to strike a similar tone. The North American leaders will talk about a slew of issues, including the Keystone Pipeline, immigration reform, and a new trade pact. While international politics will dominate the meeting, it comes at a time when Mexico is undergoing a lot of change. The Mexican president has implemented an ambitious reform agenda. NPR's Carrie Kahn is on the line now from Toluca, where today's meeting is taking place. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, I understand the president isn't even spending the night there tonight. It's just in and out. What's the point of this whirlwind meeting?
It is a very quick meeting. It's about 6 hours they'll all be together. There'll be a trilateral meeting, and then the president will meet on the sidelines with both Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Mexican President Peña Nieto. And like you said, probably in those sideline meetings, more of the interesting aspects of the summit will be talked about. I'm sure Prime Minister Harper is going to ask him about the Keystone Pipeline and why is it taking so long and what's the holdup and let's hurry up. And Peña Nieto may discuss immigration and security issues with the president. But when all three of them together, it's all about trade and commerce. And this is the 20th anniversary of the North American Free Trade Agreement, so that's on everybody's mind right now.
Right, trade and commerce. And, you know, we've seen a lot of articles in the press on this side of the border about how there has been this increase in the Mexican middle class, that Mexico is doing a lot better now economically. But is that really the case there? Are most citizens really seeing an increase in upward mobility?
It depends where you are. Mexico's a huge country, about 120 million people, and there different parts of Mexico have different industries and different economies. The export economy is doing very well, and that's mostly in the center and the border regions where there's an amazing aerospace industry in Mexico. The car manufacturing industry is booming, and so that sector of Mexico is doing very well and providing middle-class jobs, but still nearly half of Mexicans live in poverty. Wages are terrible. The minimum wage is very abysmal. Most people are forced into the informal economy, which still dominates the Mexican economy, which is a problem for Mexico because it wants to modernize, but it still has this large poor and informal economy that they have to deal with. So it depends where you are, and you know, there's also the security issue, which is just dominant in Mexico, despite what you'll hear coming out of the summit today or from Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto. He doesn't like to talk about the ongoing security issues in the country and drug trafficking and violence.
Right, right. So that's sort of the elephant in the room. They're not going to touch it at all?
Well, they will because you know, in these briefings that we got from the White House senior officials and also from Mexican senior officials, they all say, you know, security is number one for economic prosperity. We can't ignore it, but it's really not on the agenda today, maybe inside conversations. And the U.S. continually says it continues to support Mexico in its ongoing security issues and battling drug trafficking.
Now, you were just in Michoacán, which is pretty near where the summit is taking place today. And really, from your reports, it's an extraordinary situation where there are now citizen militias or armed militias that have sprung up to take on the cartels, I guess, in the absence of any protection from the state.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just 60 miles away from here, so they can't really ignore it too much. But Michoacán is in a difficult situation right now. The past year, these civilian vigilante groups have sprouted up. They call themselves self-defense groups to fight a ruthless drug trafficking cartel there. It's called the Knights Templar. It's a crazy quasi-religious group that has a lot of morality and preaches all the time, but they turned from most their main activity of drug trafficking to extorting and kidnapping in the countryside there and really terrorized the population. Then they just couldn't take it anymore, and they rose up and took up arms. And this was a very difficult situation for Peña Nieto, which, interestingly, he was just in Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum, mm-hmm. where he loves to tout his economic changes here in Mexico and his reform agenda. But the first question he was asked was about Michoacan and the security problems there. So last month, he sent in thousands of federal troops to the region to try and stem off what was looking like an all-out battle between these vigilante groups and the drug traffickers, and so try and bring the peace. And they've tried to legalize the self-defense groups, and it's just it's a quagmire there. People have called it Mexico's Afghanistan. You know, the federal forces can't really stay there and take over functions of the government, the state and local government, but they can't leave either. So mm-hmm. it's just a very difficult situation for Peña Nieto.
And this is an area that's a very rich agricultural region, so it's something that he needs to protect for his economic policies to succeed.
Yeah, and it's interesting because NAFTA has done wonders for that region, too. You know, most of the limes and avocados and mangoes that we get are from Michoacan, including a lot of the Michoacanos, who are one of the largest immigrant sending states, too. So it's funny, when I go there, every time I'm there, I could talk to people about Long Beach or about East L.A. or their favorite restaurant down in Boyle Heights.
Oh, that's funny. Like,
they know every place in the United States. Michoacanos are everywhere.
Right. So do they want something more from the United States in terms of protection?
It's interesting that you ask that, because we'd ask that question. I was just there last week. And so I'd say, you know, President Obama's coming. Is there anything you want? And more times than not, I would hear people say, you know, the United States will send the Marines to Kuwait for oil. Why won't they send them here to Michoacan to protect the avocados and the limes? It's just as rich, and we need their help. So it's not so much the nationalistic cry that you've heard before, we don't want American intervention. These people were terrorized by this drug cartel. They got absolutely no help from their local or state representatives, and they were looking for help in any way they can. But hopefully there'll be some sort of resolution. It's just such a difficult, complicated situation right now in Michoacan. And in other states, those self-defense groups mm-hmm. are popped up in at least five other states around Mexico. It's a difficult situation, and it's an embarrassment for Peña Nieto as he tries to project this modern Mexico, and he has this, you know, civil war here right in his backyard.
Carrie Kahn, NPR's Mexico City correspondent, and she's going to be reporting later today on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, on the summit between President Obama, Enrique Peña Nieto, and Stephen Harper. Carrie Kahn, thank you so much.
Thanks, Madeline.
And stay tuned for in-depth analysis of today's meeting in Mexico on To the Point with Warren Olney. That begins at 1 o'clock, right after Press Play. Los Angeles is the country's film capital, but Hollywood isn't our only claim to fame in terms of the arts. We have theater, we have opera, we have classical music. But one thing the city has long lacked is a signature dance company along the lines of, say, the New York City Ballet. Well, choreographer Benjamin Millepied set out to change that by creating the LA Dance Project. Millepied is a former New York City Ballet dancer who leapt to celebrity status after choreographing the movie Black Swan, that starred Natalie Portman, whom he later married. His LA Dance Project debuted 2 years ago at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. And now, after a year of mostly touring, the company is back in Los Angeles at a new venue. Its new show opens this Thursday at the Ace Hotel downtown. Benjamin Millepied, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you.
Do you envision the LA Dance Project as becoming LA's signature ballet company along the lines of the New York City Ballet?
I don't want to say the signature company. I think they're you know, the thing about LA, which I've discovered over time, is that there are many, many interesting organizations. You know, you sort of have to find your way around Los Angeles in, you know, in many areas of the arts. And there's dance in Los Angeles. You know, it's just that now the dance needs to be really supported and nurtured, and you know, LA Dance Project is one of these, you know, efforts that that's gaining success and growing, and you know, we're excited to after now about a year and a half, where we've literally the company's toured the world and has been in some really wonderful, important venues, to come home and start to perform more in Los Angeles, which is interestingly where, in a way, it's where it's the toughest, in a way, because this is where everything has to, you know, we have to sort of fight for.
And so tell us a little bit about the show.
Well, my ballet in the show is called Reflections. It's it's one of the three ballets on the program. We have, this one work that I choreographed last year with music by David Lang, who's LA-born composer, wonderful composer who I worked with several times. And, one of the other works is by Justin Peck, who's a young choreographer, who's very talented. He collaborated with Bryce Dessner, the guitar player and composer from The National, who is a very, very interesting classical composer who recently worked with the Kronos Quartet and I think soon with the LA Philharmonic. The third work is a world premiere by Hiroaki Umeda, who's a Japanese choreographer. I was interested in him because of his movement and also the way that he works with technology. He has usually very, very interesting, very beautiful sets that are digital and really interestingly with the dance.
So you have incorporated a lot of LA artists in these ballets. And so I'm wondering, did you do that on purpose because this is the LA Dance Project that you wanted to capture something uniquely LA?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, investing in the city, investing in collaborations with other institutions in the city, because I think, yes, starting a dance company in LA, seemed like to a lot of people like an impossible task. Collaborating and gathering strength by uniting with, working with MoCA, working with the LA Phil, obviously working with the Music Center, like is some of the things that are important to do.
But why is it seen as an impossible task? Is it because LA is not that interested in a strong dance community?
I don't even want to say it's impossible in LA. I mean, starting a not-for-profit dance company in America today is a nearly impossible task. There's no such thing as government funding, and as you know, and it's all you have to raise privately. And I think it's not even so much that it's LA. Yes, LA has a history of failures because, frankly, the level of ambition was too high. I think it wasn't so much that they wanted to do too much too fast. I think that's why some of the companies in LA, in Los Angeles, failed.
Well, you have been criticized for not actually being here in LA, that you have taken a new job directing the Paris Opera Ballet. And so how is it that you can be an artistic director of the LA Dance Project, but your main job will be with the Paris Opera?
Does anyone criticize Placido Domingo for being in several jobs at the same time? Does everyone criticize Dudamel for being doing several jobs at the same time? I think it's a bit of a joke, frankly. I've created this company in LA, and I've given it. It's been a hell of a lot of work, and I have absolutely no desire, at all to abandon it. Quite the contrary. And so, yes, I was offered what is, probably one of the best positions in the world in the dance world, by running Paris. And it's going to be an incredibly, interesting experience. Completely different. I've worked 20 years in America, and I come back to Paris with an American experience. What it's doing for me is giving me a reach in the dance world, in the arts world, that I never had to this extent, and that LA Dance Project will beneficiate firsthand. I'm going to be making sure that LA Dance Project keeps growing, and I'll be present. And there's no reason that, frankly, I can't run the Paris Opera and also work with LA Dance Project.
But it doesn't require your full attention?
It has my full attention, and it's going to have my full attention. Again, is it not what many, many musical directors do? Isn't it what many, many opera directors do? It's just so much that it's not a tradition in the dance world. But, the truth is that I set up also a very different kind of environment with LA Dance Project. I have dancers that I've given a lot of freedom and a lot of independence to. It's not the kind of environment where I'm a father figure, you know, daily at work with them. But they know I'm there for them, and I'm present. I make work. I program, you know, very carefully, and I get to see more dance now and have a bigger reach than ever. Honestly, it's a positive thing. It really is.
So, after this run at the Ace Hotel, what's next for the LA Dance Project?
The company will be going on tour. You know, we'll be back in the fall. There's some things that we can't announce yet, but that are coming. We'll be back in LA performing at the Ace Hotel and so forth.
Okay, so if you want to see the LA Dance Project, your chance is now. They're performing Thursday through Saturday at the Ace Hotel downtown. Benjamin Millepied, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the science of winning and losing, how science can be used to improve athletic performance, both physically and mentally. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Science is fun, fun.
It's Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time for Lab Rats, our regular segment on all things science.
Study of science, a richer, more rewarding life. Science is fun, fun.
All right, today, the science of winning and losing and not hitting your musical buttons on time, which, of course, is topical. The science of winning and losing because of a little sporting event happening in Sochi this month. In addition to all the physical training that goes into an Olympic victory, what goes on in an athlete's brain can be just as important when it comes to winning and losing. Poe Bronson is co-author of the book Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, let's talk about Olympic athletes and whether nature or nurture is to play here. Are they just wired differently than we are?
Well, it's really interesting because they are wired differently, but it's not just nature. There are genetic components. There are hormonal components that happen during fetal gestation that prime them to have an endocrine response to challenge. But more important, and far more important, is the lifetime of wiring that they do through repeated experience and stress acclimation. One thing I'm struck by looking at all of these fabulous events is from, you know, half pipe twists and turns, it's like landing a crashing helicopter, what they do, to throwing quads in the men's figure skating these days, or with the women's jump, the ski jumping, where they had to fly a length of a football field in the air on skis and then land it, you know. Mm-hmm. Is it? It's both enormous risk-taking, which is one set of neurology, and at the same time, absolutely avoiding mistakes. Because in a judged contest or in ski jumping, one tiny little mistake, you're out. You can crash, you can get seriously hurt, and you can be out of the medal rounds. And so both there's one set of neurology for avoiding mistakes and another set of neurology for taking risks. To do them both at the same time, careers, is one of the benefits you get from enormous amounts of practice and acclimating to the stress, to the point that what these athletes do have is the ability to take stress and pressure and have it help them perform better, not worse. It actually helps them do their best.
Well, it's interesting you're talking about neurology, and so that's obviously in the brain. And are you saying that that's more important than whatever physical perfection they have?
You know, and some of these ones, it's, you know, they're fit. But what does it take to fly through the air and land it? You know, or some people would say, well, what the best half pipers have is that they live near a half pipe. You know,
yeah.
Growing up, the if you took all of the biological predestination type factors together, people say that adds up to about 50% of the equation. If you take all of the experience effects and the development effects of your childhood together, those add up to about 50%. So it's a tie. It's kind of a 50-50 deal. It is very much what you do with it.
Okay. Let's talk about an upset today in Sochi. It was in the men's hockey, the Russians and the Finns.
Final couple of seconds. The Finns with their sticks in the air. The Russians, for the third consecutive Olympics, will not get a medal in ice hockey, and the Finns have a date with the Swedes in one of the semifinals on Friday.
Okay, so the Russians lost 3-1. That was a big blow. Here they were on their home turf. They were the favorites going in, and yet they lost. What does science tell you about that and how that happened?
You know, it's interesting because overall there is a home field advantage. You know, it's about, if you, rather than flipping a coin, you get about a 7% extra advantage for playing at home, and the Russians are here playing at home in front of their audience, but under such enormous pressure that they often, and they have the last three Olympics, played worse under that pressure, and that there are certain teams who develop a culture where playing at home in a really big game actually is worse for them. What's going on in their body, in their mind, is it's triggered by that stress is manifested as a slightly different ratio of noradrenaline to adrenaline, which triggers vasoconstriction. The blood vessels throughout their entire body, the smooth muscle lining them, constricts, and it shoots up the blood pressure. They can't breathe as well. But most importantly is it acts on the brain, and it tunes up the brain's fear networks and tunes down their reward networks, and they literally get kind of stiffer and less mentally flexible, and that shows in the way that they play.
So when you fail, you are destined to fail again and again. You're sort of wired to fail if you fail.
Oh, well, it's like mistakes can be contagious amongst figures. It's not that they're wired to fail, or individually, it's that they collectively have this identity where they become afraid of disappointing people, and that's not getting into the mental state we talked about at the beginning with the ski jumpers and the half pipe people. And once you become sort of cautious, avoiding mistakes, you tend to make more mistakes. And that sort of playing cautiously feeds on itself. And that, in this situation, is fed on itself from one Olympics to another. You see it in certain sports. There are certain teams that in soccer in the Champions League, a team like Arsenal has trouble playing at home, even though they can play great away. It becomes a sort of a culture of the team, and it becomes self-fulfilling.
But it's more than just what you're saying is it's more than just psyching yourself out. There are actually chemical changes taking place in your brain.
Absolutely. You know, we have a huge endocrine response to challenge. It's so interesting that, like, and this is true not just in athletic sports, but, say, cancer surgeons, and the night before cancer surgery, they get a 500% boost in bloodstream testosterone, that their motivation is pumping them up, and they're literally getting a hormonal thing. And then the testosterone acts on their brains, goes into the neurons, and goes into the nucleus of the cells and triggers production of yet other neurotransmitters that work throughout the brain. There's very much a physical manifestation in the body, a physiological manifestation of every mental state we have.
Mm. And so are some people just wired to handle stress better than others?
Absolutely. There was actually a genetic factor. It's called the COMT gene. It's been given the nickname the Warrior gene, and it's evenly distributed in our population. And there are one quarter of us, because we all get either one of both genes from our parents, one quarter of us are genetically predisposed to be warriors. We handle stress really, really well. Our brain thinks clearly under stress. In fact, we need the stress to think our best. And there's another opposite quarter of us who our brains do not think very well under stress and pressure. We optimize when we're in essentially a non-stressful environment.
Ted Ligety won the gold in the giant slalom today, and he was favored to win. He won by a lot. But your research says that it's kind of anticlimactic to win the gold.
You know, it's one of the interesting things is how silver medalists feel far less satisfied and happy. When they're on the podium, literally, they smile less than bronze medalists. Bronze medalists are relieved to get any medal at all. They're thinking, oh my, I if it wasn't for a couple hundredths of a second, I would have not had a medal at all. But the silver medalists are often thinking, if I'd only 200ths of a second more, I could have won a gold. And so they've done these studies of the athletes on the podiums. They're literally looking at how much they smile, and you see that the remember that Michaela is not impressed.
Yeah.
Last Olympics. Yeah, that's really happening. I mean, think of Bodie Miller crying this week over his bronze medal.
Well, and also crying because he was being pushed to talk about his brother who had died. But yeah, I mean, in the giant slalom, he wins 20th. So that's also he was expected to do a lot better. And so I'm wondering if there's anything really quickly in the last 10 seconds that we regular, normal, mere mortals can take away from this, watching the athletes compete in Sochi.
Yeah, one of the biggest ideas is that we also tell ourselves all the time that stress undermines our performance. The scientists don't agree. They do like Harvard graduate students studying for graduate record exams, and if they just tell them, you know, actually anxiety can help you improve. It's your body producing energy. People will score. They score 60 points higher out of a test 800 from just understanding this idea that actually stress can help you, not hurt you.
Poe Bronson, author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Thank you.
Thanks for talking.
My pleasure. And there's a lot more of Press Play coming up, but first a news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What images come to mind when you think of boarding school? Do you think of bucolic fields, gothic buildings, Harry Potter? Well, how about congested streets, high-rises, and car horns? Here we are on Figueroa. The 110 freeway sign is right there. A lot of traffic. We're in downtown.
We are in downtown. My name is David Unruh. I am the founding headmaster and CEO of American University Preparatory School, or AUP.
AUP is a new private boarding school scheduled to open this fall. I spoke with David Unruh on the corner of Figueroa and 3rd Streets in downtown LA. There aren't many pedestrians here during the day, but cars choke the intersection as they crawl toward the 110 on-ramp. We're standing in front of a Hyatt Hotel. Attached to it is a nondescript office building and a closed-down movie theater. And that's where the classrooms and dorms
will be. We're looking at 4 floors of space that used to be leased out office space that is adjacent or attached to the hotel.
He expects to welcome 150 ninth and 10th graders this August, eventually expanding the school to a full 4-year high school.
We've got applications from all over the U.S., from many different foreign countries, Egypt, China, Korea, Thailand, South America, Brazil.
And now we're getting to the heart of what could determine this school's success, foreign students. This new boarding school is owned by a Chinese investor named Wang Wei. His interest in starting it is personal. Wang lives half the time in the Chinese city of Shenzhen, but he sent his own teenage children to live with families here so they could attend high school in ritzy San Marino.
His children were here and he was back and forth.
I see. So he thinks, oh, I wish I had sent my kids to boarding school. Is that his thought?
I think so. And I think it also, you know, people are already doing this, and we think it can be done better.
And so he knows people in China who would love to send their kids to a place like this?
I think so, yes.
Turns out Wang is riding a major wave in education right now. The number of foreign students attending American high schools has exploded in recent years, from around 6,500 in 2007 to more than 65,000 5 years later. And most of those students come from China, followed by South Korea and Mexico. Evelyn Young is the director of curriculum and assessment for the new boarding school downtown. She says the students want to come here because they eventually want to go on to American universities and they want to be prepared for the American style of teaching.
The reason why we're called American University Preparatory School is because we are preparing international students for American universities.
So this is really a way to sort of a gateway into American universities for students who are already looking, or their families are already thinking that they want their children to go to an American university.
Exactly, yes.
At $45,000 a year for tuition, room, and board, American University Prep could be lucrative if enrollment meets expectations.
So Wang Wei, this is his dream, and this is a for-profit venture, I assume.
It is.
He expects to make a profit on this?
Well, I I think eventually. But the other thing to be said is that I don't think anyone would go into the education business if you, A, just wanted to make money, or if you wanted to make a lot of money. I think this is a venture of his and of ours that is really more of a passion. And the for-profit nature of it really describes the business structure more than anything else.
Unruh expects half his students to come from abroad, but AUP has its work cut out for it in competing for international students. California is the most popular destination for foreign high school students, and schools all over Southern California are capitalizing on that. Betty Peterson is International Admissions Director for the Fairmont Organization, which runs a private high school in Orange County.
Right now, our total population on campus is 680 students. Approximately 70% of those right now are international students.
So when you started, it was probably a majority domestic.
Oh, right? For sure. Absolutely.
So 20 years ago, yep, there were probably very few international students.
Yeah, definitely. And you go through cycles. I mean, you know, back in the kind of in 2005 to 2008, Korea was the hot spot. You know, then when the economy really started to suffer here, the economy in Korea did the same thing. And now we're just seeing the Korean market come back. On my campus, on the prep campus right now, I would have to say about 65% of our international student population are from mainland China.
And what's the tuition?
We're roughly somewhere between, for at the high school level, anywhere from about $42,000 to $52,000.
You have to be fairly well off to go
there. Yeah, with the international markets, that isn't a concern.
The kids who go to Fairmont live with host families who receive a stipend from the school. They're expected to act like surrogate parents, attending sporting events and taking them to the movies. And that's another reason why boarding school could be attractive to foreign parents. What if their kid doesn't bond with a host family? And really, they'll be on their own soon enough. In 4 years, they'll fan out to colleges across the country, already schooled in how best to succeed in an American classroom. The boarding school is not the only new Chinese development downtown. In fact, the face of downtown will change significantly in the coming years, and Asian capital is the driving force. Plans to build a new development on a parking lot downtown near Staples Center and LA Live have languished for years, but now a Chinese development company called Greenland has bought the site for $150 million, and work on what's being called the Metropolis Project, a set of four towers, is about to start. Brigham Yen is a downtown advocate. He's also a realtor, and he blogs at DTLA Rising. Hi, Brigham.
Hi, Madeline.
Well,
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. And tell me more about the Metropolis Project.
Well, the Metropolis Project is basically one of the largest mixed-use projects that is going to break ground very soon in downtown LA. It's very exciting, just kind of going off what you mentioned, because it's been delayed for so long. The project was actually planned for in the 80s. So over the last three decades, yeah, it's just been sitting as a parking lot, a surface parking lot.
And was it the Chinese money that made it happen?
Yeah, it really is, because in 2011, IDS, who was the original developer or wanted to develop it, they were going to break ground in 2012. And so it just wasn't able to happen. And so financially speaking, and so Greenland steps in, and they're one of the hugest companies in China, and they're doing a whole bunch of projects all around the world. They come in and infuse the project with enough money to begin construction.
Yeah, I read that Greenland is also the driving force behind the stadium in Brooklyn on Atlantic Avenue as well,
yeah,
just to put it in context.
Exactly. The Atlantic Yards, yep, in Brooklyn.
All right. And so there's other Asian money coming into downtown. The Wilshire Grand, which was notable last weekend for breaking a Guinness Book of World Records for the longest concrete pour in history. So this will be the largest or the tallest building west of the Mississippi. And this is being built with Korean money?
Yes, it's actually being developed by Korean Air, which is a subsidiary of Hanjin Shipping, and they're based in South Korea. And they're putting in $1 billion into this very exciting skyscraper that will redefine LA skyline. It's going to be mixed use. They're going to have a 900-room hotel, four-star hotel, with office space and retail on the ground floor. And it's going to be really interesting because it's going to have something LA hasn't really seen yet before. They're going to wrap the tower in really interesting lighting, like LED lighting, which can basically change colors and patterns, which could be useful for holidays, like, you know, or special events like breast cancer awareness. And so that's going to really add something substantial to the skyline. It's really exciting.
So something like what the Empire State Building does.
Exactly.
Tell us more about this Metropolis project and what it's going to look like.
It's being designed by Gensler, which is an architect firm based in downtown LA, and is going to have four towers. And so basically right now they've released their preliminary conceptual rendering, so it's going to be refined. But the basic gist of it is you're going to have four slender, elegant towers that are abutting the 110 freeway. So again, this is also going to help redefine the downtown skyline as well, because you have these four soaring towers. It's going to be glass, possibly with some metal elements, metallic elements involved. And you're going to have a hotel, you're going to have residential towers, you're going to have ground floor retail and restaurants that are going to activate the street. It's really going to inject some much needed life into this part of South Park.
So Gensler is the architecture firm, and it's also designed some other buildings. Why is it dominant, this architecture firm?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know exactly why they're dominant. I think they do really great designs. It probably has to do with them relocating to downtown LA and, you know, establishing those, you know, those connections, those business connections in the community. And I think that was part of their strategy as well. They saw that downtown LA was growing rapidly. And so to relocate their offices from, you know, Santa Monica to downtown, now they are closer than ever to all of these developers that are, you know, building downtown.
What is the attraction of downtown LA to Asian investors?
You know, I think they see the rise of downtown and they understand it, because in Asia, you know, where the, you know, right now where Korean and Chinese money are coming from, you know, Shanghai and Seoul are very urban cities, and, you know, it's very dense and compact. So they see Los Angeles, and it's kind of the gateway already for a lot of Asian immigrants. And they see downtown as a smart investment. It's growing rapidly. There's, you know, somewhere around 5,000 units of housing under construction. And they really see that it's a viable market.
Is it safe to say that without Asian investment, downtown wouldn't be as vibrant as it is right now in terms of development?
Possibly, just because right now the two that have stepped up to the plate are Asian and they are investing a lot of money here. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, if these two companies didn't come downtown, we would have a lot less. Yeah.
Yeah. And all the related businesses as well. The grocery stores and the boutiques and the yoga studios and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's all synergistic. Everything works together.
What's the time frame for these two massive projects, the Grand Project and the Metropolis Project?
Well, the Wilshire Grand Project is supposed to be completed by the end of 2016. They're going to have a grand opening in March of 2017. That's what they're planning for. And the Metropolis Project is the hotel portion of it is supposed to open on February of 2016. And I know they're working really hard to try to break ground on the other two, which is two towers, which is part of phase two. But that one, the timeline is a little bit more ambiguous.
Brigham Yen is a downtown advocate. He's a realtor and he blogs at DTLA Rising. Brigham, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're on All Knees here now to give us a little preview of the show at 1 o'clock.
Hi. We are loaded today. We have the main subject is Hillary Clinton's inevitability, which is something that I'm very dubious about because it's 2 years until the first primary.
Right.
But I have to tell you,
you got to start now raising
it's
money.
It's very persuasive. And, you know, there really aren't a lot of candidates who might challenge her. But then we also have a wonderful preview, not preview. We have a preview of the President's Summit, but we also have an update from Kyiv and what's going on in the Ukraine and why it's so important to the European Union and why it's so important to Russia. And how what a serious situation is, and it is, rather. And
how fast it's moving.
Very fast. Whoa. And nobody seems to be in control.
Warren Olney, and To the Point, that's coming up in 15 minutes from now on KCRW at 1 o'clock. Thanks, Warren. And coming up on this show, the LA Archdiocese settles its final class action child sex abuse lawsuit. Documents reveal how Cardinal Roger Mahoney was involved in keeping the victims away from police. So we'll talk about that coming up on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The LA Archdiocese will pay $13 million to 17 victims of clergy sexual abuse. The settlement marks the end of an era for the Archdiocese. In 2007, it paid out the largest settlement in church history, more than $600 million to settle more than 500 cases. And the majority of the cases in this case revolved around a priest named Nicholas Aguilar Rivera. He allegedly molested 26 boys in Los Angeles over a 10-month period in the 1980s. And he is still a fugitive today. Joining us now is Kelly Goff with the LA Daily News. She was at a just recently concluded press conference. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on, Madeline.
And this press conference was given by the victims?
Yes, it was the attorneys for that represented the 17 victims who are represented in this lawsuit.
And what were they saying?
What was interesting about this today was that it was one of the first times that we've been able to hear in a deposition from Cardinal Mahoney himself. And they pointed out that, you know, he at this point still seems to deny in his 2013 deposition that the Archdiocese had done anything wrong in the handling of these cases.
Now he allegedly gave the accused, this priest, he gave him time to flee the country before alerting the police. Is that right?
Yes. According to the victim's attorneys, the Monsignor, now Bishop Thomas Curry, was told about the allegations brought by two victims of this priest, and he was given the notice on a Friday afternoon. And then asked to keep quiet. The priest was then told Saturday, and by Monday morning, he had fled to Mexico.
And then he also ordered church officials not to turn over a list of altar boys to police who were investigating?
Yes, that is what we understand.
And this was in the confidential file that was made public in this deposition?
Right. Yes, those have since become public.
Okay. I want to bring in Joelle Castex from SNAP. Welcome back.
Thank you.
What is your reaction?
Well, you know, this case, I heard you say earlier that it marks the end of an era. Actually, it marks the beginning of a new era.
Oh.
Because the reason that these victims were able to come forward was because they were intentionally defrauded by the Archdiocese. They were offered counseling, but were never told they had legal rights. And we believe that there might be many, many more victims of men like Nicholas Aguilar Rivera who were offered counseling, but were never told that they had legal rights and were never told that they had criminal rights and that they could put their predator behind bars.
But has the statute of limitations run out in terms of criminal prosecutions?
Well, in the case for, you know, depending on when someone comes forward and when the abuse occurred, there could be people with open statutes. Nicholas Aguilar Rivera has a warrant out for his arrest in the United States and in Mexico. If he's found, he will be arrested.
So what's happening with that? Are police actively trying to pursue him and find him, bring him to justice?
Right now, he's on the most wanted list in the state of Puebla in Mexico. And I know that in California, law enforcement would be more than happy to get him behind bars. But he's hiding, and he's hiding with the full cooperation of the Catholic Church in Mexico.
Now, what do you make of what Roger Mahoney said in this deposition in terms of saying he basically said, well, there's no evidence that these were the boys who were abused, and so therefore it would be more upsetting to turn over the list to police for these altar boys. And then he said that the altar boys may have been too old to have been abused.
You know, it was a deliberate work on his behalf to make sure that victims did not come forward. Nicholas Aguilar Rivera came to California with a history of abusing boys. Cardinal Mahoney was warned about it. He knew that if the police went and talked to these altar boys, they would find more victims and learn about more abuse. And he was doing everything in his power to make sure that those kids never, ever talked to the cops.
Kelly Goff of the LA Daily News, what is the reaction today from the Archdiocese?
The Archdiocese has said that they are looking forward, and that they are looking forward to putting this behind them. They have said even yesterday that they have paid quite a bit of attention to this, and that, you know, they have treated this with some respect and with due diligence to the victims.
And is there any indication that there will be more lawsuits coming forward?
I have not seen that indication, and I know that reports said that this may be the end of that, but as Joelle mentioned, it's really an unknown, despite the fact that the Archdiocese is looking forward.
And Joelle, what do you know, if you can add into this, what do you know of any potential lawsuits? I think one was announced yesterday, actually, against LAUSD and the Archdiocese.
Yeah, it was against a teacher in Sylmar. You know, I believe that we're going to see many more victims coming forward. Anytime you see a settlement like this, and anytime that documents are released, victims become angry, those who have not come forward, because they're going to see that men like Cardinal Mahoney were covering up abuse. And victims are going to come to terms with the realization that to get healing, they're going to need to use the courts. And I think that we will find over the next few years that victims are going to continue to come forward, because we've never seen any change in the Archdiocese. Mahoney's never been punished, so how do we know that things have changed?
Tell us a little bit more about the victims in this particular case. How has this affected their lives?
You know, child sexual abuse is a crime of shame and secrecy, and it is devastating to victims. I can't speak, you know, on behalf of the particular victims in this case, but in general, I mean, we deal with depression, addiction issues, alcoholism, violence, anger. We lose many victims to suicide. It is devastating because a child's world is destroyed by someone whom they love, and their views of sexuality and power and innocence are completely ruined. And it takes many, many years of healing for many victims to even come to terms with the fact that what happened to them was not even their fault.
Now, we've talked a lot about the Archdiocese and its role in this. What about the police department? Do you fault them at all for not taking a more active role in this?
Well, in the case of Nicholas Aguilar Rivera, the cops were all over it. They found 26 victims of Aguilar Rivera, and they didn't get those names from Cardinal Mahoney. They went out to a local elementary school and talked to kids and their parents, and that's how they found these victims. But by this time, Aguilar Rivera was already off in Mexico. The Los Angeles Police Department has been very, very good in following up on these cases when it comes to punishing the men who hurt kids. Unfortunately, when it comes to people like Cardinal Mahoney and Bishop Curry, statutes have lapsed. So, you know, the more victims come forward and the more documents we uncover, hopefully we'll be able to punish those men as well.
And as we said, this is around $700 million that the Archdiocese has paid out to settle more than 500 cases, a lot of money, the most of any archdiocese in a child sex case. And I'm wondering, Kelly Goff with the LA Daily News, if this has been really difficult for the Archdiocese to make up financially.
You know, I apologize, Madeline, but I'm not quite sure how financially they have fared. I did just kind of jump into this. Mm-hmm. However, I do know that $700 million, given what the Archdiocese takes in, is still a pretty significant amount. And it's probably quite hoping that there are not going to be many more lawsuits where it will have these sort of heavy payouts.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Kelly Goff with the LA Daily News and Joelle Castex, Western Regional Director for SNAP. That's the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests.
Thank you.
Jolie Myers in the house now to share the mail. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. We had a whole segment about the Trader Joe's pretzel dust-up yesterday.
Yes, we did.
And it inspired some dust-ups of its own on our website. Well, we wondered, how do they keep prices so low, and why are their parking lots such total quagmires? And listener Mark from Burbank says that the two things are related. He commented on our website, "I'm sure one of the factors in keeping their prices so low is the limited parking. Not a lot of money tied up in real estate." thank you, Mark, for putting the two, for connecting the dots. Another listener pointed out, though, that Trader Joe's is owned by the German grocery chain Aldi, and because it has a parent company that has a lot of reach, he says that's how they keep the prices down. So I feel like we learned quite a bit from our listeners on the website.
Doesn't answer the parking lot question.
I feel like that's the existential question of our time, and I'm not sure we're going to be able to hang our hats on an answer anytime soon. And I'm still not going to there, so I don't have to bark. We've been looking at the income divide in Los Angeles for our series Fault Lines. You and I have gone downtown to look at changes there and what it means to live at the median income of LA County. We want listener stories as well. We want your stories about moving up and down the income ladder, watching your neighborhood change for better or worse, like we're seeing downtown, and how the income divide is affecting you guys. And we want you to tell us on our blog. It's blogs.kcrw.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Tweet at us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Do we have any more ways to contact us?
We have so many different ways. It's kind of mind-numbing. Email. Do you do email? PressPlay@KCRW.com.
Thank you.
Could do that one. And then calling us. Well, actually, if we like you, we'll play you what you say on the air. 844-PRESS-PLAY is the voicemail. So that'll do it for us here at Press Play. Thank you, Jolie Myers.
Thank you.
And Twitter, again, at KCRW Press Play, or my own, at The Mad Brand. Warren Olney, and To The Point up next on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.